on the line with us right now is Aaron Kunani. He is an adjunct professor of media, culture, and communications at New York University and teaches terrorism studies at John Jay College. He has been a visiting fellow at Leiden University in the Netherlands and Open Society Fellow and the editor of the journal Race and Class. He is the author of The End of Tolerance, Racism in 21st Century Britain, and the more recent book, his new book, The Muslims Are Coming, Islamophobia, Extremism, and the Domestic War on Terrorism. Good morning, Aaron.
Hi, Chuck.
It's great to have you on the show, sir. I think the first place for us to start is with a very devil's advocate question. What would you say to somebody who, is, like Bill O'Reilly, somebody who is very suspect of Muslims and Islam being a religion of terror? What would you say to somebody who said to you, well, of course we should be targeting Muslims. Of course we should be profiling Muslims. Of course we should, because these are the people who attacked us on 9/11. What is wrong with the logic of targeting the people from the religious background that targeted us on 9/11?
Well, I'd say two things. Firstly, how we go about responding to terrorism. You know, if we have a very wide kind of broad range of surveillance where we're putting millions of American Muslims, you know, we're spying on them, we're collecting huge amounts of data about their lives because we think that there's something about being Muslim that makes them a risk of being a terrorist. Then what we end up doing is collecting huge amounts of information, most of which is useless. And that actually makes it harder to see the really important stuff. And so actually, just from the point of view of preventing terrorist attacks, it's counterproductive. And then the other, you know, the other kind of more political point I would say is, you know, we have in the United States certain principles around civil rights. And that's ultimately what the United States' national identity is defined by. And so if we say, well, just by being from a particular religion warrants some kind of suspicion, then we're going against the kind of principles that, you know, that we should hold as sacrosanct when we're thinking about what it means to be American.
You mentioned the difference between being an Islamist and a Muslim. I think this is incredibly key in the misunderstanding that Americans have about Islam. Islamism no more represents Islam and being a Muslim, than Pat Robertson's run for the presidency here in the United States represented accurately how all Christians in this country felt. If it did, he would have won the presidency. He didn't even win the Republican nomination. How much does it undermine our ability to understand Islam, to understand the war on terror, when there is no distinction between what it is to be an Islamist and what it is to be a Muslim?
You know, actually, I think it's even that point that we need to distinguish between being a Muslim and being an Islamist. In fact, I would go even further than that, and I would say we have an assumption that not just conservatives make, but liberals make as well, that somehow the root cause of terrorism is some kind of religious ideology, right? So, you know, this is an argument that liberals will often make, which is that we need to distinguish between ordinary Muslims who are just, you know, like any other citizens of America and are not a threat, but then there's this minority of extremists who have this religious ideology that makes them a risk. And those people should be considered suspect, right? Now, actually, that is also something that doesn't stand up to the evidence, right? What drives terrorism is actually not a religious ideology, but political issues around the world in large part. And so we need to just get a lot deeper in understanding what is terrorism and what causes it. Because unless we do that, we're not going to be very effective in reducing the risk of terrorism. So I think actually a much more productive way of thinking about terrorism is to think about the kinds of political contexts that we actually create with our foreign policy that makes terrorism more likely. And the whole question of what particular interpretation of Islam you have, whether you interpret it in a moderate fashion or an extremist fashion, is actually, I think, a red herring here.
Right, because you make this, you write, two main modes of thinking pervade the war on terror, one predominantly among conservatives, the other among liberals. You were just mentioning this. The first mode locates, that's the conservative mode, locates their origins of terrorism in what is regarded as Islamic culture's failure to adapt to modernity. The second, the liberal, identifies the roots of terrorism not in Islam itself, but in a series of 20th century ideologues who distorted the religion to produce a totalitarian ideology, Islamism, on the models of communism and fascism. The problem with both of these approaches is that they eschew the role of social and political circumstances in shaping how people make sense of the world and then act upon it. If we didn't do that, if we didn't eschew the role of social and political circumstances in shaping how people make sense of the world and then act upon it, how would we view Islam differently?
Well, I think what we'd say is, just like any other religion, you know, Islam provides a kind of broad moral framework for looking at the world, but how someone actually puts that into practice in terms of their everyday life and in terms of thinking about, you know, questions like the legitimacy of violence in different contexts, that's always going to reflect the particular circumstances that one's in and reflect one's political analysis of events around the world, right? So, you know, a good way of thinking about this is to look at Hamas, the Palestinian terrorist group. So Hamas uses religious language to legitimize its acts of violence that it carries out. But it also uses religious language to legitimize its ceasefires when it introduces one of those. So the religious part of its ideology is not what's determining whether it decides to act to deploy acts of violence at one time or another or not. What's determining it is how it sees the particular political context in Israel and Palestine at that time. So actually, rather than, you know, spend a lot of time trying to think about what is the particular kind of religious extremism that causes Hamas to be a terrorist organization, it's much more effective to think about what is the nature of Israel's military occupation of Palestine, and what is the decision making within Palestinian groups as to how to respond to that in different circumstances. It's about politics rather than religion and culture. But we tend to find it much more comfortable to think about these questions by saying it's something to do with their culture rather than thinking about something to do with politics. Because if we start to think about it politically, then we also start to have to take some responsibility for our foreign policies and the effects of those.
Does the Quran, does it any more than the Old Testament, the New Testament, the Torah, any other religious book, does it endorse, does it legitimize, does it allow for violence any more than any other religious text?
Well, you know, the Quran is a text that is open to lots of different kinds of interpretation, right? So just like any other religious text, if you want to find verses in the Quran that legitimize acts of violence in particular contexts, you can find them. If you want to find verses in the Quran that say, you know, violence is wrong, you'll find them, right? And you can refine that in all kinds of ways. So there's certainly lines in the Quran that say, you know, that any killing of another human being is as if you kill the entire human race. On the other hand, there are lines in the Quran that say, you know, in this particular context, this killing of an unbeliever was legitimate. So, the question is not so much what does the Quran say in itself, but what determines whether someone chooses to interpret it one way rather than the other, right? And that's a question that you can't answer by no matter how many lines from the Quran you quote. You know, we tend to have this debate where you know, you'll get the kind of bloggers who have a kind of Islamophobic agenda who'll quote these lines from the Quran who say, look, the Quran says kill the unbelievers. And then you'll have someone else come back and say, oh, I found another line in the Quran where it says you shouldn't kill the unbelievers. And they'll have this debate where they trade lines from the Quran. Actually, I would say the whole thing is a complete waste of time because they're ignoring what determines whether someone chooses one of those lines or one of the other ones, right? And that is not a question that can be answered through thinking about religious ideology.
Right, because you can...
And that's something that we, you know, if you think about religions that we might be more familiar with, like Christianity, that the same thing would apply. Christianity has been used to legitimize, hatred towards gays. It's also been used to legitimize the liberation of African Americans in the United States. It's been used as a liberation theology in Latin America. It's been used, for a whole wide range of political positions, and legitimizing violence in certain contexts, legitimizing nonviolence in other contexts. Now, we cannot say, well, one of those interpretations of Christianity is more authentic than the others. In a way, it's how someone interprets their religion is between them and their God. So I think the way into this is to, in a way, detach the question of religion from terrorism.
Right. And it's just like you always hear commentators saying, mentioning the 72 virgins that Muslims will get if they go to heaven when they die as a martyr. But you don't hear, that would be equivalent to the commentators repeating each and every time they mention the Bible, do you know that you cannot wear, or the Old Testament, you cannot wear two pieces of clothing that are woven from the same, woven from different cloth. You don't hear them repeating that over and over and over again. So let's get to that one cliche phrase that everybody does look toward, which is the 72 virgins that supposedly you get this reward when you go, if you kill other people, if you are a martyr. So how much is that misleading? How misleading is that? How indicative of that is, how indicative of Islam is that?
I would actually be very strong here and say, I don't believe that anyone has decided to become a suicide bomber because of the prospect of virgins in heaven.
And by the way, just as an aside, I don't want to be around 72 virgins. I mean, do you?
Okay, yeah, I mean, I agree.
Right.
You will find a debate within amongst Islamic scholars about interpreting those passages, and most of those scholars will say that that to portray what's being discussed there as this kind of harem of 72 virgins is not really what's being intended in that passage, and it's more an attempt to just kind of describe this kind of moment of bliss in heaven. But if we want to understand why someone becomes a suicide bomber, you need to understand the situation that people's lives are in. Let's take some of the context within which we might think about this. If you are in Western Pakistan and you've seen your village eradicated in a drone strike, you've lost close relatives. Those kinds of things are much more significant in driving you to want to be involved in acts of violence than a particular interpretation of the Islamic classical sources. Similarly, if you want to understand why is there suicide bombing in the Middle East with regard to Israel, look at the decades long occupation of Palestine and the impacts that has on people's lives, right? I think it's those sorts of things that are where we'll find the answers. Albeit, those are much more difficult things to talk about, right? Because Israel is supported by the United States, so we start to have to ask questions of ourselves rather than just ask questions of someone else's religion. But if we're going to be kind of intellectually honest and morally responsible about these questions, and I think we need to face up to some of these more uncomfortable realities.
And not only that, but the religion also allows us to dismiss the actions that are taking place on the ground. The religion allows us to dismiss the direct events that are affecting people, and we can have some sort of distraction about what these people must be like based on whatever stereotype that we have. So it takes responsibility away from the actors. who are directly affecting people's lives. We are speaking with Aaron Cunani. He is an adjunct professor of media, culture, and communication at New York University. He has a new book out called The Muslims Are Coming, Islamophobia, Extremism, and the Domestic War on Terror. It's published over by the great folks over at Verso Books. So you make sure you go to our website and click on the link, and it takes you directly to where you can purchase that book directly from the author. You argue that from both the left and the right, modes of thinking are not free-floating. They are institutionalized in the war on terrorist practices, actively promoted by well-resourced groups, and ultimately reflect an imperialist political culture. Together, they give rise to the belief that the root cause of terrorism is Islamic culture or Islamist ideology. They thus constitute an Islamophobic idea of a Muslim problem that is shared across the political spectrum. As a result, a key aspect of national security policy has been the desire to engineer a broad cultural shift among Western Muslims while ignoring the ways in which Western states themselves have radicalized, have become more willing to use violence in a wider range of contexts. In your opinion, why doesn't the left see their thinking as Islamophobic, a charge they often give the right, and the left argues they are above?
Right. Well, I think, you know, one of the, you know, I think there are lots of important voices on the left that are taking a good position on these issues. But there is a strand of thinking, call it left or liberal, that, you know, that has bought into the idea that religious extremism is the biggest problem that we face in the world. Right. And that's something you'll hear from, you know, people like some of the kind of so-called new atheists, like Richard Dawkins and Sam Harris, and also people who, you know, a lot of people in the administration who broadly have a liberal politics have also kind of adopted that view. I think it's been important under the Obama administration in particular. I think we're in the Bush years. We kind of got used to a certain kind of narrative coming from the administration that was something like a kind of clash of civilizations narrative, where people talked about Islam being at war with the West and so forth. And then that was kind of reworked in the Obama years into a softer kind of narrative that sort of said, you know, it's not that there's a war between Islam and the West, but there is a conflict that comes from religious extremism. And you know, and that has been a way in which the war on terror has kind of become normalized, right? So neoconservatives kind of invented the war on terror, but liberals have normalized it and made it actually made it permanent. And so, you know, part of what's going on here is to do with the kind of institutionalization of a lot of the practices that Bush introduced. You know, while we officially no longer torture, in practice, we still do, you know, have people being transported around the world for torture. We haven't shut down Guantanamo. We have intense mass surveillance of fellow citizens within the United States. All of these things that were initiated after 9/11 are still with us. And so, how does the administration legitimize those practices? It says that there is this fundamental threat that we face, and it describes that threat in a different way from the Bush era, but nevertheless, it still has this narrative that talks about religious extremism.
You know, the word Islamophobia, it seems like it's a post 9/11 word, that Islamophobia didn't exist before 9/11. Obviously, you know, you can go back to the Crusades and point towards the clash between Christian culture and Islamic culture, but the idea of Islamophobia seems to be something that occurred after 9/11 due to the attacks of 9/11 being committed by people of the Islamic faith. But you write about how so much of what has taken place as far as law enforcement and their targeting of Muslims is about settling pre-9/11 scores, wherein people had problems with political Muslims here in the United States. How is this not something that just started after 9/11? How are we? What was the Islamophobia? What was occurring within the United States before 9/11? And how were those scores settled, unrelated to 9/11, after 9/11?
Well, I mean, I think you know you can go back during the Cold War period where you see a number of things happen. You actually see a kind of in some contexts around the world, you see an attempt by the U.S. government to actually partner with political Islam within the Cold War. So political Islam becomes a potential ally actually against communism. But then in the 1990s, in particular, you start to get an attempt by some people to think of Islam as the new enemy after communism is no longer seen that way. So you know, in the early 90s, you have people like Bernard Lewis and Samuel Huntington who introduced this language of a clash of civilizations, and want to think about the world now as not involved in a conflict between capitalism and communism, but involved in a conflict between Western culture and Islamic culture. So that, you know, that certainly predates 9/11. And then in terms of, you know, the other strand to this is the strand that runs through the Iranian Revolution and how we've made sense of that in the United States. So that by the 1980s, you already have a lot of the kind of main themes of the post 9/11 war on terror. You already have those as part of the discourse in America with regard to Islam. Even as far back as the 1980s, you had plans coming out of the Justice Department for the kind of mass incarceration of Arab Americans. Which wasn't put into practice then, but was certainly on the drawing board, and then those plans were actually implemented after 9/11. I don't think it works to think of Islamophobia as a kind of spontaneous reaction to 9/11. I think the best way of thinking about Islamophobia is as a form of racism. That is in many ways similar to anti-Semitism. So, you know, what happens with anti-Semitism is you take a group of people who share the same religion and you turn them into a race. That's what anti-Semitism does in the 19th century. So Islamophobia is doing the same thing. It's taking a group of people who share a religion and racializes them into a race. And then that enables you to not only kind of demonize them in the public mind, but also then to implement all kinds of policies to do with incarceration, surveillance, etc.
You write, most discussion of state surveillance attends to wiretapping, collection of internet communications data, closed-circuit television cameras, and other forms of electronic surveillance of our online and offline lives. But central to counter-radicalization practice is another form of surveillance that is addressed less often, using personal relationships within targeted communities themselves for intelligence gathering, and that's what's happening with the Muslim communities here in the United States. When community organizations and service providers, such as teachers, doctors, and youth workers, develop surveillance relationships with law enforcement agencies, when government community engagement exercises mask intelligence gathering, and when informants are recruited from communities, surveillance becomes intertwined with the fabric of human relationships and the threads of trust upon which they are built. So would you argue it is worse surveillance because it is more intimate?
Yeah, in many ways. I think one of the, you know, over the last year or just under the last year, we've had this really important debate that's come out of Edward Snowden's whistleblowing about the National Security Agency. In a way, that debate has been significant, but it's been quite abstract and legalistic, and it doesn't really pose the question of who is affected by state surveillance and in what ways. And when you look at, in the intelligence community, electronic surveillance is called signals intelligence. But there's also what the intelligence community calls human intelligence, which means intelligence you get from informants undercover agents and so forth, right? And that kind of piece of the overall picture of what state surveillance looks like has kind of been lost, and it's something that in many ways has a much bigger impact on communities. So right now in the United States, we have at least 15,000 paid informants working for the FBI. We don't know exactly what kinds of crime those informants are on paper meant to be tackling. But given that half of the FBI's budget is to do with counterterrorism, and given that the way that the FBI understands counterterrorism is almost entirely focused on Muslim Americans, it's reasonable to assume that we have, you know, at least half of those 15,000 informants operating in Muslim American communities, gathering information about the kinds of political opinions that people are expressing, gathering information about the kind of religious opinions that they're expressing. And so it creates a climate in which, you know, people do not express political opinions in the mosque anymore. When a new person comes into a mosque, they tend not to, you know, be trusted. You tend to treat them with suspicion. You know, in East Germany under the communist system there, it was said that there was one spy for every 66 East German citizens. And according to the data we have about the number of informants and intelligence analysts working around Muslim American communities, it looks like we have roughly the similar ratio. So the Muslim Americans are actually being subjected to similar levels of state surveillance that East German citizens were receiving under the Stasi. So that means that, you know, that means that we're in a situation where a community in the United States is being dramatically deprived of its freedom of expression, which is a bad thing for this society for a number of reasons.
Right. Now, I just want our audience for a second to imagine if you were in such a targeted group. You know, you can't talk to your family and you can't talk to your friends about what your political beliefs are, possibly your true political beliefs, whatever they are. They might even be peaceful beliefs. But if you believe that you have, you know, if you're Muslim and you express to somebody, I'm somebody who believes in nonviolence, but I believe that we can, through nonviolence and democracy, change the government in the United States. Who knows how somebody is going to interpret that, especially if somebody who is on the FBI payroll, who is afraid that that check isn't going to keep coming because they haven't fingered enough people who are potential terrorists. So I want people to imagine that just for a second, that you are, let's say if all of a sudden Roman Catholic blew up the White House and all of a sudden they were targeting all the Roman Catholics, or if an Orthodox Jew blew up, whatever, the capital of in Springfield, I don't care what it is, how would you feel if all of a sudden everybody within your community was being targeted? So one of the things I was thinking about in that kind of scenario is the fear that somebody who is Muslim would be seen as a sellout for being incredibly pro-American, for trying to cover whatever their political beliefs are. Is that a problem? Is there pressure within the community to keep it real while simultaneously not doing anything that would bring unnecessary scrutiny to you or your family?
I've not really come across that. I mean, I would say, you know, the Muslim American community is quite diverse in terms of both its national origins and in terms of its kind of income levels as well. So, you know, about a third of American Muslims are African American. The other two thirds come from all kinds of different parts of the world: Africa, Europe, Asia, Middle East. And in terms of, you know, for every Muslim American who's a taxi driver, there's another who's a doctor or an accountant. So you have a kind of broad spectrum in terms of class as well. And so what you do have is a bit of a dynamic where particularly those Muslim Americans that, you know, were before 9/11 doing quite well, living in the suburbs and probably saw themselves as a kind of model minority in a way. And then 9/11 comes and suddenly they are seen as the enemy, and their kind of class status doesn't really help them all that much to escape from that. So I think for those people, there was a sense of, okay, I'm going to wave the American flag, keep my head down, and wait for this to go away. The trouble is that it's still here, almost 13 years on. And so now you're starting to see in the community, I think, a much richer discussion about what is the best way to deal with this. Obviously, there's a lot of fear about people who become informants. I think there's an understanding that people are under incredible pressures. The motivations that people have for becoming informants is in part financial, but more often it's to do with pressure that you're getting from the government. So when you look at who's become an informant, a lot of the time it's people who've had a criminal conviction and then they do a deal with the government around that. It's people who've been put on terrorist watch lists so that they're unable to fly anywhere, and so they do a deal with the government to get off the watch list. It's those kinds of pressures, and so I think people have an understanding that the problem is not the kind of individual corruption of an informant, but the kind of wider institutional practices that are creating this fear in the community.
And
to just give you one other illustration of like how extreme this is, there's a case that I'm writing about at the moment of a guy in Amherst, Massachusetts, who met a woman, started dating her, and got married to her, only to find out a few years later that throughout the whole time she was a paid informant for the FBI who'd been tasked with targeting the guy. So we used the word intimate a moment ago. It couldn't be more intimate than that.
You write, leaders of targeted Muslim communities have become intimidated by the general mood and align themselves with the government, offering themselves as allies willing to oppose and expose dissent within the community. Everyone who rejects the game of fake patriotism falls under suspicion as opposition to extremism becomes the only legitimate discourse. I have noticed that when a Muslim is running for office, they have to denounce terrorism. You don't expect that, there isn't that kind of requirement, that kind of criteria that's necessary for somebody who is white or somebody who is African-American or somebody who is Hispanic to immediately have to denounce terrorism. And that clearly shows what you were saying is kind of the racism that we have against Islam in this country today. So in the U.S., does this lead to only the most hawkish Muslims becoming the representatives of their community or in elected office? Are we looking at a future of community leaders and Muslims who are in elected office being only from the most conservative, the most pro-American ranks, Republicans, if you will, in order to make certain that they can take office because they're trying to shed that image of terrorist?
I think there has been a phenomenon where a lot of the the prominent spokespeople on behalf of Muslim communities have had to adopt a kind of posture of going that extra mile to say, I denounce terrorism in any form, and kind of really emphasizing their kind of pro-American credentials beyond what would be expected of anyone else. That's certainly a phenomenon. There's also a phenomenon where you look at the main kind of community organizations and the kind of advocacy organizations for Muslim Americans that you see one or two of in Washington, D.C. They will self-censor themselves around their views on foreign policy. So they will talk about their concerns maybe about how Muslims are being represented in a television program or in a film, because that's something that they feel that Americans can relate to. It's very similar to something that you might hear from a Jewish advocacy group or an Italian American advocacy group. But when it comes to trying to participate in the debate in the United States about our foreign policy in the Middle East, they will actually not say a word, because that to do so will always be interpreted in America right now as you not just fellow citizens expressing a different opinion about a policy question, but as an attempt to infiltrate the federal government with a kind of covert terrorist agenda. And so one of the costs for us is that we lose the knowledge that a part of our fellow citizens have about the impact of our foreign policy on the Middle East, right? Because Muslim Americans, by and large, have a lot of knowledge about what it means for Palestinians, Iraqis, Egyptians, we should be able to draw on that knowledge in informing a more effective foreign policy in the United States. But instead, we've suppressed that. And so, forget the kind of issue of civil rights and freedom of expression, it ends up being counterproductive for America as a society going forward.
You know, we were speaking with Michael Glennon earlier of Tufts University, and he was saying how the national security policy and the policymakers here in this country, he believes that there is kind of a double government in which, and he doesn't think that this is any kind of conspiracy theory or anything like that. There is a national security policy and policymakers who stay within the government, and they are the ones who guide the national security policy, and that's why you can see very little change in the national security policy. When Democrats or Republicans are in charge. You write, sharing an ideology with terrorists is thus considered a pre-crime, the ideology of being an Islamist, a stage in the radicalization process. The threat isn't really from Al-Qaeda Central, explained former FBI Assistant Director John Miller, as much as it's from Al-Qaeda-ism, deciding that Al-Qaeda-ism, an ideological construct devised by the FBI, is a threat means that radicals who do not espouse violence but whose ideas can be superficially associated with Al-Qaeda. So are they chasing something? Is the FBI chasing something that is exaggerated or doesn't exist?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we could get into the data on terrorism within the United States that's carried out by Muslim Americans compared to other groups. And, actually we face a greater terrorist threat from other groups compared to the threat from Muslims in America who are citizens or permanent residents, right? Which totally contradicts the way we actually allocate our resources to counterterrorism domestically. But I think what's going on with the FBI in terms of how it does counterterrorism is it has decided that rather than focus on people who are actually involved in terrorism in some form, it's widened its approach to actually want to criminalize ideology, right? So this is why the line from John Miller, the FBI assistant director, a former assistant director, is important, because he talks about how the threat is not from Al-Qaeda, an actual terrorist organization, but from Al-Qaeda-ism. So once you widen the threat to something called Al-Qaeda-ism, you can then start to criminalize people for an ideology. And then when you convict those people, not for anything they've done, but for what they're saying, you can then, go back to Congress every year with this great data saying that you've successfully prosecuted, 100 terrorist-related crimes, and it looks like you're doing a great job. But actually, all you're doing is inventing a threat that isn't there, and then claiming to have dealt with it, so you can keep your funding going, and it looks like you're running this efficient counterterrorism program. But to a large degree, you're kind of fantasizing into existence a threat that isn't real.
Just two more questions for you. You write, liberal America finds it easy to condemn the early war on terror of the Bush years as a moment when hysteria took over, leading to blanket fears of Muslims and misguided warmongering. But now liberals say we have moved beyond that, and we understand that Muslims in America are just like the rest of us. However, just as in The Russians Are Coming, the liberal caveat is that's the movie, The Russians Are Coming with Carl Reiner. The liberal caveat is that Muslims are acceptable when depoliticized. They should be silent about politics, particularly U.S. foreign policy and the domestic national security system, and not embrace an alien ideology that removes them from the liberal norm. But isn't that the talk of the day? Depoliticization of everything. We've had the Nation's sports writer on the show, Dave Zirin. He insists that they're trying to depoliticize sports as much as possible, and the sports industry actually insists that they are trying to depoliticize itself as much as possible. But Dave points out that, in fact, it's not. You see warplanes flying over. You see very much the patriotic propaganda. So it is very much a sports arena, is a very much politicized place. Is this just... a reflection of the world that we live in now in the United States, where we want everything to be depoliticized. We want to be militantly centrist.
I mean, yeah, I think to a large degree that's right, and I think Dave's point is absolutely right that what on first glance seems to be about depoliticization is actually just a kind of deeper politicization in favor of the right and in favor of the status quo. So you know, I think what you see happening with you know, in relation to American Muslims, certainly has a lot of connections to what we're seeing affecting all kinds of different communities. You know, I think you're absolutely right that we don't really have politics in the United States anymore. I mean, this is true of Britain as well. We don't do politics. What we have is a kind of show of political difference. But the real political issues just never surface, and so what you end up with is a lot of people who feel frustrated about things that are happening in their lives, whether it's whether it's the issues that Muslims are facing or the issues that people on low incomes are facing or the issues that African Americans are facing, but there's no outlet for that. There's nowhere to go where people can participate in some kind of political engagement that could speak to those experiences and talk about strategies for change. So what you get in place is you get some very narrow forms of identity politics that kind of substitute for any real kind of politics. You get conspiracy theories and you get blaming other people as a kind of lowest common denominator kind of way of thinking about people's issues, right? So that context is a context which is the worst kind of context if you're trying to reduce violence of any kind. So I think you know, it's really important right now that we find ways to start these political conversations again. The when we talk about Edward Snowden and NSA surveillance, it's not about whether tech corporations are losing a bit of money because they're losing foreign business, nor is it about what is the precise set of reforms to the FISA Amendment Act that's going to, you know, rebalance security and privacy. It's about people's everyday lives and their freedoms and about social control and how these techniques are used to control populations. And so that is a political conversation. We need to start having those conversations, and that's something that all of us, I think, need to kind of think about how we do that again, right?
One last question for you, Aaron. We've been speaking with Aaron Quinnani. He is an adjunct professor of media, culture, and communication at New York University and teaches terrorism studies at John Jay College. He's got a brand new book out called The Muslims Are Coming, Islamophobia, Extremism, and the Domestic War on Terror, published by the great folks over at Verso Books. Aaron, is this just an excuse for you to try to get a movie made with Rob Reiner called The Muslims Are Coming, The Muslims Are Coming?
I haven't got my Hollywood agent just at the moment, but I'm open to offers.
One last question for you, Aaron. It's our question from hell, the question we hate to ask. You might hate to answer. Our audience is going to hate the response. You write, the consequences of making the notion of radicalization central to the domestic war on terror are far-reaching. When the government widened the perceived threat of terrorism from individuals actively inciting, financing, or preparing terrorist attacks to those having an ideology, they brought constitutionally protected activities of large numbers of people under surveillance. My question from hell for you is an ideology that promotes violence against the government a constitutionally protected activity, and should it be?
Yeah, I mean, I think we need to go back to our understanding of freedom of speech that came out of the 1960s and 70s, where we set a limit on freedom of speech that was about, is what you say going to lead? Is it going to produce imminent lawless action? Is the legal phrase, right? And so, you know, the reason that actually is the best way of doing this is because you obviously want to have some kind of concept of incitement to violence, so that when someone is directly inciting violence, you criminalize them. Um, but But you want to make it possible for people to do things like talk about revolution, talk about complex questions about when is violence legitimate in certain contexts, right? Now, we may well disagree with a lot of those opinions expressed, but one of the fundamental kind of principles of American society, but liberalism in general, is we're better off if we enable people to have those conversations without being criminalized than if we suppress that, because that kind of suppression of those discussions is more likely to produce context within which people turn to violence. And I think history bears that out. If you look at the history of terrorism, terrorist campaigns tend to get going when a community or a social movement faces violent suppression from government. So I think that the test of whether you've crossed the line to speech that should be criminalized is, does it lead to imminent lawless action?
Aaron, it has been a pleasure to have you on the show with us this morning. Aaron's new book, Aaron Kunani, has been our guest this morning. His new book is The Muslims Are Coming, all about Islamophobia. You got to check out this brand new book over at Verso Books. You can find a direct link to it at the front page of our website right now. Again, the book, The Muslims Are Coming, all about Islamophobia, with our guest this morning, Aaron Kunani. Thanks so much for being with us on this morning's show.
Thanks for having me. My pleasure.
Take care.